There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Way we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have y'all on this Tuesday. And phone number didn't change from last hour. 343-0106. 343-0106 for the text line and the phone line. And reminder, too, with the FM Talk 106.5 app, through the magic of technology or whatever, you can send us one of those talkback messages from your phone. Just hit the microphone icon, record the message, emails it to the show, and you can play it back here on the air. All right, my friend and esteemed grand poobah of the Alabama DC Fish and Rodeo, when it comes to judging, the big judge, and he also has a bunch of titles, and he's a doctor, and he's at USA Marine Sciences and Dolphin Island Sea Lab, and pretty darn good fisherman himself, Dr. Sean Powers. Hey, man.
Hey, man, we like our titles in academia.
Yeah, you've got it, man. Like when I see the titles this man has, if you have a card, is it on the back as well? Like,
continued on back. No, I haven't done that yet, but a couple of more years, I'll get enough.
I want to talk about the school real quickly before we get into a lot of stuff this hour. The growth of marine sciences at the University of South Alabama, student growth, has been something.
Oh, it really has been. I mean, we knew that when we launched the undergraduate programs, because we were graduate only for a long time, masters and PhDs, that there was a demand. But just the response of students to realize what an amazing place it is to study at the university, but also our location, just our mm-hmm. location between the Delta and this part of the Gulf of Mexico. We've far exceeded our expectations, both in marine sciences as well as the environment and sustainability science. And sustainability is becoming such a big thing. Corporations have sustainability officers. Everybody, for the most part, is trying to look at their footprint, both to save money, but also to do the right thing. And so I think we've gotten into a market just at the right time, and it's just this location, once we get the students here, and it's not just students from the Gulf Coast or Alabama, we get a ton of students from the Midwest. I think they draw an arrow down, and we're one of the places they look.
Yeah, you talk about the Delta, but you could have a education somewhere, let's say in the Caribbean. All right, so you've got coral reefs there and associated waters and deep waters nearby, but you don't really have brackish water at that level, right? You could go from a freshwater system into a brackish water system, into a saltwater bay system, into the whole way to thousands of feet of water in the Gulf and tile fish on the bottom. It's like the range here of what you can study is pretty amazing.
No, and you're absolutely right. This range, because we have that deep water, we're so relatively close to us, and we have the productive bay and then the watershed right above it, and that whole gradient. You can study all of that in a one-day trip.
Yeah.
So it is. And while people think of, marine biologists as Jacques Cousteau, Clearwater, coral reef, mm-hmm. beautiful systems, those systems actually aren't very productive. They're That's very right. diverse, and they're very pretty. But where you look at where
they didn't have the fuel.
Public gets yeah. their energy, their food, all of those, it's from these incredibly productive areas like we have off Alabama.
Well said, and it's right here at home. Let's talk about some of those. First of all, having you in here with your credentials, your education, I got to ask you. So the big story turned around yesterday afternoon and this morning, dealing with mullet, And I know I didn't prep you for this mullet question, but People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, has come out and asked the Floribama to not use mullet in the mullet toss this year. And they suggested they would provide them with rubber fish for them to throw across the state line. You're concerned with mullet population being used for for being thrown across the state line.
Yes.
How are the stocks doing? How are the mullet stocks?
This will cover the whole range of topics from your first hour segment to now this one.
Are we okay with mullet populations?
I can safely say, even though the stock assessment has not been any time recent, that I think the mullet population can withstand the harvest necessary to support the,
the scientific
mullet toss.
Okay, so scientific opinion, the stocks are good. What about this? PETA says that fish recognize themselves in a mirror. Have you heard this? This is part of their screening.
I haven't heard this one. There is a big debate in the literature by scientists as well. And, you know, people trying to make a case, not surprising to your listeners, preferentially cite some sources and ignore other sources. But there's a big debate over whether fish feel pain in terms of the way we perceive pain. There's no doubt that if you handle a fish, there's elevated hormone levels and all of those things.
But they didn't feel...
And when humans have that signal in their bloodstream, they feel pain. We know that. But other animals won't interpret that as pain. I mean, it's a signal to run. It's a signal very different thing. Feeling pain, essentially, unless you have the capability to learn, there's not much evolutionary advantage of feeling pain. Because think about that. It's going to slow you down. It's going to...
Right.
Slow your responses. For us, we can learn. So fire hot, don't put my hand there. And we have the ability to learn and recognize cues.
And here I thought the fish could, because the pain is the motivator not to do something again. That doesn't mean there's higher level thinking. It means do this, Al, you know, move away from this. But you make a point there that if there's no evolutionary benefit to banking, there's nowhere to bank the knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's just a reaction.
Correct. So really it has to do how much learned behavior. And some species have shown, dolphins have a tremendous capability behavior.
I'm talking fish. I'm talking, I'm not talking marine mammals. It's a different story. I think actually, if you look at the dolphins and you look at marine mammals, probably 10% of them are smarter than 40% of humans. That's... Get some of the stats.
I don't know about that.
But no,
there's always this debate over whether fish feel pain, and now there's lots of studies to look at even neural responses, chemical levels, hormone levels, and still the thing that I guess we'll never understand is how does the fish perceive all those things? Do they trigger pain, or is there some way it can trigger a response that's more useful to the fish in evolutionary terms? Yeah.
See, so there we go. So we brought real science into my two-bit discussion of the rubber mullet at the... Well, I think they're not going to use... I think they're going to offer the Billy Big Bass. Remember the thing that go on your wall and you play and sing Take Me to the River?
Bought one of those for my father-in-law.
See, so there you go. I imagine they're for sale cheaply right now on eBay. All right, this is... When you sent me this story or this research the other day, I said, holy cow, because obviously you've made a lifetime of paying attention to oysters. I have from a non-scientific level, and we talk about oysters actually quite a bit on this show. It's funny how it ends up different guests and the decline of oysters, right? And looking at here locally, what's being done to bring back and having places for oysters. But then this paper comes out, and it's Mobile, our area, Cedar Point and all that, and Apalachicola, and a commonality that may be part of, I cut this out here, y'all. It says, just read a sentence of what came out here, what I was saying. It said, the future of the wild oyster fishery in the northern Gulf of Mexico is largely uncertain due to changing environmental conditions and declining abundance in harvestable oysters. Specifically, rising temperatures can directly impact the physiological thresholds of the eastern oyster. So it's getting too hot for oysters?
Yes. So we published this paper just recently, and it looked at a topic that's becoming more and more relevant, especially in the Gulf, and that is marine heat waves. and we didn't have this word 15 years ago. It really looks at not only the increase in average temperature, which we've been seeing, but it's not the average that's going to get us. It's the fact that, that you have extremes on both sides of this. And what this looked at was in years that we know, because the state has actually got a rich, very well-done monitoring system where they've gone every year since the early 70s and monitored oyster reefs for the new little oyster spat, as well as what the adult population is. Years when the spat are low correspond to years that we've had really long, pronounced heat waves.
Okay, so it's not affecting the adult or the non-spat oysters as much as it's the next generation in the spat.
Correct. So, and it might not be purely just temperature. I mean, temperature varies with a lot of things. Temperature is incredibly important for oyssters because it tells them when to spawn. All of their reproduction is based on temperatures. They want to get that first drop in temperature.
And I guess explain that to people, too, this process, the oysters spawn, and then how they go find a new home.
So imagine you're an oyster. You're eating plankton, being happy.
Filtering all kind of stuff, yeah.
And then something in your body tells you, wow, it's getting warmer. I should put some more energy into reproduction.
Okay.
I should try to replace myself now. So it sends out eggs or sperm. Oysters are what we call sequential hermaphrodites. So they are.
Are they early in life male and then female?
Yep.
Or, okay.
Yep. And it makes sense. Sperm is relatively cheap to produce in the animal kingdom. Eggs are very expensive. So once you get bigger, you produce eggs. So you release eggs and sperm in the water. That's all temperature cued. And then you have fertilization, and over the next 3 weeks, you develop into a little bitty oyster that's floating along the water. It has a little thin shell at the end of it.
Okay.
And then it settles. It finds a hard substrate, hopefully another oyster to settle on. They're gregarious, which doesn't mean they like to party. That means it likes to
stick to another oyster. Yes.
So, and once they settle, then they'll grow. All of those processes are influenced by temperature, but they're also the most vulnerable stage of their life because any kind of shock in salinity temperature can kill them very quickly. So what we did was looked out over this whole time period that the state had data.
70s on to now.
Yep, and it's sure enough, every year that there was poor recruitment correspond, well, not every, but 92% of the years where there was poor recruitment, there was a heat wave.
Okay.
We did the dangerous thing. I talked to my postdoc, who's the first postdoctoral researcher, who's the first author on the paper, and said, you know, I hate to even suggest this, but let's go someplace else to see if it happens, because maybe it's just something unique about Mobile Bay. The most related are Apalachicola. Mm-hmm. And Apalachicola's had serious problems with their oysters. And sure enough, in Apalachicola, same thing. Pronounced heat waves were the reason for, or at least associated with, low recruitment.
Now, I talk about this when we get back, but I wonder, is it not like, you know, that you have bad year classes, right? But you know, from what I'm worried about, next couple months, turkey poults and quail chicks, right? And we have weather sometimes, even if you have good habitat, whether you have big hatches, small hatches, those kind of things. And I wonder if that's part of this system. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Sean Powers when we return right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All Right, 124 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. I'm glad to have you all along hanging out with my buddy Dr. Sean Powers. This segment of the show, get what I'm going to do here. This segment of the show brought to you by Clint Jameson at Adventure Earth Bicycles, where I got my e-bike from now pushing a couple year and a half, almost 2 years ago. And Adventure Earth Bicycles, they do have 400 of the non-e-bikes in stock if you're into that. But if you want to see what it's all about, these e-bikes, 50 in stock at any time. You can go down, take a test ride on one of these e-bikes, and Clint will help you with the one that's right for you. Some people just need like a street bike, you know, that's e-bike. Some people need a hybrid. I have an off-road bike. Figure out what you need that e-bike for, and he'll find the right e-bike for you. Great deals going on right now. And a reminder, or two, just the same as we said during Christmas when you're buying kids' bikes there, that they come put together and tuned and ready to go so Santa isn't working in the workshop till late at night. Same thing with your e-bike. They're not only going to be assembled, they're going to be tuned properly. And when you buy your bike from Adventure Earth Bicycles, you can come back quarterly and have all the maintenance done to it, the tuning done to it, the lube the chain, make sure the brakes are working, everything. Adventure Earth Bicycles right there in Midtown. They're at Airport and Little Flower, kind of catty cornered across from Ruth's Chris. See them online at adventure-earth.com, but best to go see them in person. Check out those e-bikes. All right, we're talking oysters, and I was wondering here, did we have any other, you know, you're talking about the temperatures in this mix and how you have these good years and bad years. And I wondered, is it, you know, you have bad hatches, bad, is it part of the natural system to have a poor recruitment year? I mean, does that exist like with snapper or other fish?
I mean, sure. I mean, we've known fish, shellfish, which is where oysters fall under, all have good years and bad years. That's kind of the first thing in the early 1900s that we documented as fishery scientists, and trying to explain those good years and now trying to explain more of the bad years is really part of our business, of what we do. So, you know, oysters just don't have a lag. An oyster can grow up in a full year.
As I was wondering, from here, the time that spat comes in and anchors somewhere, is that how long till that's a size oyster that we'd be eating?
It can be as little as 6 months to inch, or it can be as much as 18 months. Now, okay, on the East Coast, it takes 3 or 4 years. So here in the Gulf, we know conditions are right for rapid oyster growth. For a fish like a red snapper or a redfish, you know, if you can predict poor recruitment, I could tell them 4 years from now that they're going to have less fish enter the fishery. So yes, that for every fish species, there's highs and lows in recruitment. That's part of our challenge is explaining that. Generally, everything has to line up perfectly for a good year. But what we're finding for oysters or any other species, one thing can cause a bad year. And in this case, we think that these pronounced heat waves during the summer can cause that one bad thing.
So they hatched out. I mean, those oysters could have hatched out the eggs and the sperm and fertilized them. But when that heat wave happens, that's when you could lose the spat.
They could, yeah.
They could die before they find a place to make the new home.
Mm-hmm. It could be directly related to temperature. It could be indirectly related to temperature. That we know when the water is hotter, we get lower dissolved oxygens. In the area, we also know that predators become more active because their metabolism is higher. So there's a variety of things that are controlled by temperature. So we don't know exactly what's causing it as far as but we know there's a strong correlation between these heat waves. And we know that we see more and more evidence that marine heat waves are causing problems for us. You had Dr. Zawinkowski on last year who talked about marine heat waves and rapid hurricane intensification, particularly in that late August, September time period. So this is the new reality that we're dealing with. It's not only that the average temperature is creeping up.
But you said, yeah,
more that you have these pronounced long heat waves.
So could you do the inverse, and we're going to go to the break in a second, and if you had a summer where you didn't have those spiky heat waves like that you could expect a better recruitment in that next year?
Correct, and that's what the data shows as well. So
interesting.
Yep. It's just that now we're getting more and more heat waves.
Sure, so we just need one of those. I remember, 10, 12 years ago, I had a rainy summer, and I swear we made 90 like 5 times the whole summer or something like that. All right, coming right back. More with Dr. Sean Powers right here on Midday Mobile.
is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. Segment of the show, and this fits, too, is brought to you by my buddy Forrest at Blue Water Yacht Sales and Service. I've been talking about all the great incentive deals on the new boats, and I do need to take a little time to talk about the service department, because Kelsey back there, I'm a big, big fan. Okay, so first of all, if you're getting the work done, you should have gotten done earlier, but they still have time for you to get the work done. Be ready for fishing. We've got Amberjack opening in May, other things we'll talk about with Dr. Powers. But if you're doing the work yourself, they've got the parts. If you want the work done, they can do the work as well. If you're looking for Yamaha parts, Yamalube, all those products. Also, in parts, if you're working on impellers or whatever you're working on, if you call Kelsey down there and say, here's my serial number on my engine, you can make sure you get the right part for that engine. You know, you go online and look, and they'll say, yeah, it fits generally models from these years. Or the, listen, it's a big deal to get the right part in those Yamaha engines. Also, Mercury, they got a great parts department. So if you call with a serial number of your engine, Kelsey and Parts will make sure you get the right part for that engine. And they can get the parts pretty much, if you order before 11 o'clock, Kelsey told me you can get the parts the next day most of the time. And plus, they'll keep a customer history on you for service and parts. So next time you call, say, well, what did I put in last time? You know, what did I need to get? They've got your record there as well. If you want them to do the work, five-star Yamaha service. You've got a master tech, only four in the entire area, can do a full line of service, the warranty and repair work, check on the warranty, anything needing work or parts. Not everybody does that, but they do that at Blue Water Yacht Sales and Service, so make sure to check them out. They're online at bluewateryachtsales.net. You can see them right here on the in Mobile on the Beltline between on the east side between the Dolphin and Old Shell, or see them at Orange Beach Marina. But check them out, Blue Water Yacht Sales and Service. Another boat person sitting right next to me, my buddy Dr. Sean Powers. Is everything going? Everything fixed? Everything good?
Everything's good. I've brought mine out twice.
Okay,
but it's mainly the wind has just been horrible. I mean,
yes,
April's always a roll of the dice whether you get good winds or not. But this, I mean, I think we've had field work scheduled for 22 days, and maybe we've gotten out five.
None
of those 5 days were comfortable days.
Yeah, well, this is this is the nature. We just hope this is going to be better by end of next month. But
yep.
We'll get to that. I want to ask you one last oyster question. Don said on the text line, question for you, Sean said, is there any way to artificially cool the water on some of our oyster farms? Maybe some type of refrigeration line in the water column that would help.
That would be energetically very costly. Now, there are things we can do, though. You could choose areas that are a little deeper. So mm-hmm. The deeper you go, the cooler the water will be.
But is there a limitation on that? Because I worry about the turbidity in our water, which is part of the fuel. Mm-hmm. But you go too far down and there's no food for the oyster, right? You got to be up where you have plankton.
I wouldn't worry so much about food. I would worry about if you go too far down, you might get some areas that turn low dissolved oxygen more frequently. So really, no, there's no way to chill water just wouldn't be economically feasible.
One more oyster question. Mm-hmm. Do we have enough places for recruitment? In other words, is the spatter floating around? Do we have areas that should be getting populated by that Goldilocks zone we talk about for oysters that aren't getting spat autumn? When we do these new zones and the work being done at Cedar Point and all that, if you build it, they will come or not?
For the most part, we still have enough larvae and surviving in the surface of the bay. Every survey we've looked at, if we put out some artificial substrate for them to settle on, we generally get way enough oyster settling. So we aren't at the point like Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Chesapeake Bay is at the point where that's no longer true. So it's still much more economically viable for us to restore by planting oyster shell or planting limestone marl, generally, if we plant it in areas that historically had oysters, they will still get oysters. It just, it might not get oysters every year, but hopefully but conditions are right once every 3 years for that to get oysters. And that, that's what we've seen. We have seen a rebound. We saw the lows of the mid-2010s, and now we're seeing a significant rebound on the wild oyster fishery. It's nowhere to where its historic levels were, but you know, there was a lot of us 5-7 years ago wondering if we would ever have a wild fishery return. And now,
and you think,
with good management, with some good weather conditions, good climate conditions, we are seeing that, and hopefully we get more good years than bad years, and that continues.
All right, from shellfish to bony fish here, you know, we're talking about this, you've written about this recently. I didn't know this was bull redfish. Like, I remember this change, and it's funny. You know, we old timers like to talk about the golden days, and I remember fishing with my kids, catching redfish. I said, y'all are living in the golden years. I said, the redfish and now for us here, you know, had been, and this is, you know, the last 15 years or so, is better than it was when I was a kid. You know, we fished redfish, but we didn't catch many of them. And they're like, to go in the Delta now, and I used to have little redfish holes. You'd go catch one or two, you know, growing up in the 80s. Now you can go in there, and there's several, you know, you're bass fishing and catching them. We did something when we stopped killing the biggins, the breeders, but that's changed back now? I mean, I thought that, like, people were killing bull reds.
So, yeah, if you look at the data, this is an article that I wrote for Tide magazine, but we're going to post it widely. Tide is a
CCA magazine.
CCA magazine, but we'll have it, we have it on our website that talks about essentially the harvest rate for above the slot redfish now in Mississippi, Alabama is about 17% of the harvest is above the slot. So these are folks that are intercepted dockside that have kept that fish above that. And that's, you know,
keeping their one over, yeah.
Keeping their one over. And really the reason the fishery has recovered so well is how well this fishery does with a slot. So, you know, essentially letting the fish grow up to 16 inches is just to make sure there's a decent enough size fish for somebody to harvest and eat. Once you start putting that release in, and it depends on which Gulf state, but it's 26 to 28 inches. You want to, as soon as they get over that mark, they're joining the reproductive portion of the population. So you want your harvest directed at fish that aren't reproducing and protecting those that can reproduce. Yeah. And slots are a great management tool. Unfortunately, once you go further offshore, once you get barotrauma and deep depth, they no longer work as much. But for the bay, you know, that model works. And each Gulf state does something different with those above slot. Florida does not allow above the slot.
Right.
Texas allows you one above the slot. You get a license with it, and you wrap
like
it around.
Like one a year? Like one a year.
One a year. And if you send it, the information back, I think they allow you to keep a second.
Okay.
Louisiana, you're allowed to keep above the slot, although there's pending regulations that are going to prevent that. And Mississippi, Alabama, you can keep one above the slot a day.
It's just to see that 17% of the harvest being above the slot. Do you have historical data on that for the last couple of decades? Because that surprises me. It was just once, you know, my eyes were opened and we went through the redfish crash, and then I, you know, everybody I've fished with my whole life were like, well, that fish a lot more, they're fun to catch. Turn them back because they make the fish we're catching in the slot. We didn't keep them, but
in general, it's been slowly increasing.
And wonder what just drives
just
that.
A slow increase. I think one above the slot are much more abundant than they've ever been.
Yeah. They're easier for people to find, especially when they're on Dixie Bar or down on the beach.
And a lot of people, that is the biggest fish they've ever caught in their life.
True.
Particularly if they're tourists or snowbirds, that is the biggest fish.
Sure.
So convincing them to release that fish is difficult. I've talked to some charter guys. It's very, very difficult.
How many people are killing tarpon, though?
I don't know of anybody.
Yeah, they go catch tarpon, the biggest fish a lot of people ever caught in their life.
Well, I mean, you can eat a redfish above the slot. Well, I mean, I don't think it's particularly tasty. I prefer
There have been bull reds killed and put in a cooler on my boat over the years. I'm not going to pretend they are, you know, hooked deep or whatever. They've been kept, and yeah, you can eat them, but they're so much more valuable making more redfish right. to catch.
And they may have worms in it. We know that mm-hmm. they generally tend to have higher mercury levels, not mercury levels that trigger any health warning, but they generally have higher mercury levels in them.
And doesn't that exist in any fish as you get to the bigger ones? They
sure, generally as you get older, yeah. It's more with age of fish, but also size of fish and what they eat. It's just one way to make sure, and we're trying to encourage people more to, before, you know, any regulations need to change, just release that fish. Take a nice picture of it and release the fish.
I didn't know that.
It's a heck of a fight.
Yeah.
There's tens of thousands of redfish a year, because redfish face other problems. If for those of your listeners who know, last few years, about every other year,
we've had kills.
And I'm worried. You know, luckily, haven't gotten a call yet.
Did y'all figure out what caused those kills?
It looks like it's upwelling from offshore of a deep pocket of low oxygen water that corresponds with some of these flooding events that we get, these heavy rainfall events. So we'll see. We're learning more and more about what causes that. We know Louisiana has done some studies that the menhaden fishery does have a significant bycatch issue with tens of thousands of red drums. So again, given that they're not the desirable ones to keep and let them go. I mean, because that's our harvest now is higher than what the historic harvest was when everybody was harvesting for black and redfish.
Oh, wow.
We can do that because the slot works and it makes more fish available to us.
Coming right back. More with Dr. Sean Powers.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
At 150 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Our guest, Dr. Sean Powers. People are asking too on the redfish. That research is in the New Tide magazine, but y'all are going to post that. And then somebody's asking, Dr. Mariana, asking about the oyster. This oyster study, is this available online?
Sure, we will post both of them. My bad. I don't think that, I forget the general audience doesn't have access to scientific journals. We don't, Sean. But we have copyright on them, and we will post both of those articles at southalabama.edu/marinesciences.
All right. So those will be available there. And I'll tell you what, if you send me a direct link, then I can post it up on our social media pages. I do want to say one more thing, get back into the fish. I love this. This is about the growth of University of South Alabama and marine sciences. Why couldn't y'all have done this back in 1989? I'd have probably changed what I did. I wouldn't be here. Maybe I'd be on the boat with you. But Brian said, the guys and I here in South's cabinet shop are building cabinets and countertops like crazy for marine sciences. Go Jags.
So I love it. Part of the growth is that the university has had to renovate some new space for us, which we're super excited. They're working on cabinetry and countertops that will be a premier analytical lab. We can run any contaminant or chemical in
that
the ocean or the water. It's an amazing partnership. The Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, through the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act, GOMESA, has helped us create this facility. And your listeners are building the cabinetry. It's cool. It's amazing to see.
I want to talk snapper, but we talk about that research facility. Can we do like a 1-minute version? Because you blew my mind. We were talking about triple tail blackfish mm-hmm. at one point. You're talking about. They don't, you know, he said this idea, they all went offshore and they all came back in. And he said, no, not so much. And you could tell by samples where these fish had been. It was like a black box recorder for them.
Correct. It's their ear bone that they use.
But the ear bone, we always thought, that just shows how old the fish is, Sean. But you said there's more there. That's what this lab could pick out.
That ear bone is largely calcium carbonate, but it picks up other chemicals along.
Y'all listen to this.
It substitutes the calcium. Other elements can substitute for the calcium portion of calcium carbonate. And it picks up those chemicals, and each estuary is unique its chemistry, and the otolith reflects that unique chemistry. And then fresh water is different than bay water, which is different than ocean water. So we can tell how those fish are incorporating. And the otolith grows fast enough that we can say, you know, for 14 days, this fish was in about this type of environment. And it's all chemistry. It's a fancy instrument called a laser ICPMS, an inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, it's one of the instruments that we have because of this funding and because of the university and the state's investment. And it's one of the unique instruments. We have researchers from around the country that come to use our instrument because we have it here at South Alabama.
Good. Y'all, this stuff is, eye-opening. All right. Back to self-serving conversation here. We're a month out. Today's 24th, isn't it? Yeah, we're a month out from snapper season.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about, we could sit and lament the drop in the tonnage for harvest, but I know we've come up a little bit from that. So where are we? It's 590 something?
Right time. Around there, but somewhere, I think it's 580 or something like that.
We're saying 580,000.
Just shy of 600,000 pounds.
Yeah, so 600,000 pounds. What's our average going into this year? Do we know what the average fish is for the equation, like what our average weight?
Not yet. We won't know that until we see what people are bringing.
So that happens early on.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Y'all are always sampling when you don't get beaten by the storms out there. What are you seeing right now? How stocks?
So we're seeing in our assessment to the state that we presented every year showed a very stable population as far as catch goes with number of fish. We did start to see that decrease in average size that we've been seeing over the last few years level off. So we're hoping that means the average size is increasing. If we're right about our science, that with these lower quotas, we should start seeing the average size increase. And we've had a lot of conversation with Scott Bannon and Kevin Anson, their chief biologist, about what's the sweet spot where we have enough days to give enough people access to enjoy this resource and still make sure that average size is something that people will enjoy.
What, over 16, please, Dr. Powers.
Well, I mean, at the height of the to cap people's expectation, at the
inches.
Height of the 9-day seasons, which we some of us all remember, you know, about one out of every two fish were above 16 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So realize that not every fish will be above.
And I was catching monsters
back then. Yeah, and we were catching monsters. Now we're at about one out of every three or four.
Okay, so that's the ratio.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the quality of your spot
sure.
and how it's hit. Yeah, so we'd like to see that average size go up. But the stock is very sustainable. So, you know, despite that, the average size decreasing, the number of snapper is actually increasing. It seems like, you know, there's an overall biomass.
Right. This is something you've talked about on this show or the outdoor show. This is this concept. There's an amount of biomass, and it's the pie is X size. And if we can cut the slices very, very thin and have a lot of them or cut them bigger, that's how it fills in.
You know, in Texas, they really like to manage their fisheries for a large average size. Well, if you think about it makes
days,
sense
though.
For Texas. It blows all the time in Texas, wind-wise. It blows all the time in Texas. So those few days they get out, they might as well have a big fish. Whereas for us, largely the time period between May and August are very cooperative to get out.
There's
so
no
we
wood
can get
left
out.
For me to knock on in here. What are you doing, man?
I'm just talking about averages.
The wind gods are listening.
Oh, they have paid me back this month, I promise you. But anyway, so trying to find that delicate piece, that's why we love collecting the science to inform the management. And then, you know, Scott and his organization tries to balance and do the impossible and make everybody happy.
It is
with the data that they have.
Well, I was going to ask one other fish question, but from the text line, this is probably the best one. We have about a minute left. Ben saying, how are the flatfish doing?
So the flatfish, we still are seeing recovery of flounder
populations. Because the anecdotal flounder stories are great this last year.
And the stock assessment does, the recent stock assessment does hold that out. That the population is increasing. not surprisingly, the fishermen see it much quicker than the model does. And I think that's because it got so low that any improvement seems to be amazing.
Yeah.
Whereas there's not that many of us out there who remember what a really healthy flounder population looks like. So I think, you know, my advice to Scott is to keep those regulations in place for a while.
Yeah, they're working. Dr. Powers, as always, man, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
All right, Paul Feinbaum Show on the way next. We'll do it all again tomorrow on the Wednesday edition of Midday Mobile. Y'all have a great one.